I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. After a damning report by the U.S. anti-doping agency, the International Cycling Union stripped Lance Armstrong yesterday of his 7 Tour de France titles. Here's Pat McQuaid, the president of the ICU, making the announcement.
UCI will ban Lance Armstrong from cycling, and UCI will strip him of his 7 Tour de France titles. Lance Armstrong has no place in cycling.
The USADA spoke with 12 of Lance Armstrong's teammates and more than 24 witnesses and examined bank records, email communications, and tests, including Armstrong's blood test results. The report described him as a ringleader who supplied performance-enhancing drugs to his teammates and pressured other cyclists to use these illegal drugs. Armstrong refused to meet with the USADA and has maintained his innocence. Today on Radio Times, Lance Armstrong, professional cycling, and the problem of doping. Chris Cooper is a professor of biochemistry, director of the Center for Sports and Exercise Science at the University of Essex. He's also the author of a book called Run, Swim, Throw, Cheat, The Science Behind Drugs in Sport. And he joins us from the Multimedia Center at the University of Essex. And Chris Cooper, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
Also with us is Joe Lindsay. He's a contributing writer for Bicycling Magazine, has closely followed Armstrong's career, has written on pro cycling and cycling's doping problem for over a decade. He's also an amateur bike racer. And Joe Lindsay, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be here.
And Joe, if I could begin with you, because these rumors certainly have dogged Lance Armstrong's career for some time now. What's the significance of the USADA's investigation and findings?
I think the first significance is simply that the amount of it, the 202-page reasoned decision, the fact that there were 26 people who testified, including, as you mentioned, a dozen former teammates. So we've had a 13th teammate, Stefan Kjærgaard, come out today and say essentially the same thing. There was doping on the team. It was organized by the team. So I think the sheer weight of it is something that is probably the most remarkable thing about this investigation. As you mentioned, there have been allegations before, but they have always come out piecemeal, one by one, or a few things at a time, and then the just amount of this is staggering.
Well, and even in your own coverage, Joe, I'm curious about how close you were able to get to the findings of the USADA.
You know, that's a very interesting question, Marty, because one of the criticisms that has come up is of journalists, particularly cycling journalists, why didn't you uncover this? And as a journalist, you could get fairly close to the story, but you could never quite get it. People simply, for a lot of reasons, simply weren't willing to speak on the record. So if they told you anything, it was off the record, and if you tried to get it on the record, then it would not happen. That's because for a long time, they were, you know, that their livelihoods were tied to this as well. And then they also, as becomes evident in reading the reasoned decision, greatly feared Armstrong's retribution. He could be a very vindictive former boss and former teammate, and he would do pretty much anything that he felt he could get away with in order to keep this secret.
Did he ever, not threaten you directly, but was he ever vindictive with you?
I ended up on what was called the blacklist, which was a list, basically, of journalists who were persona non grata within the postal team. And you could get there by a number of different means, but the primary way that you would get there would be asking too many questions, either of the team or of other people, and it would get back to the team that you'd been asking questions. And they would basically say, this guy's no good, don't talk to him anymore. So this was the kind of thing that journalists face, where you would be, if you ask questions, your access would oftentimes be cut off.
Chris Cooper, let me turn to you, and even quoting from the U.S. anti-doping agency, saying that basically Lance Armstrong and even members of his team were running, quote, the most sophisticated, professionalized, and successful doping program the sport has ever seen. From your perspective, and from what you know from these reports, why do you think they were able to be so, quote unquote, successful in eluding the authorities?
Well, it's sort of sophisticated partly and partly unsophisticated. I mean, the unsophisticated bit is that if they ring the doorbell, you just don't go to the door. You don't answer the door, you hide. So a lot of low-tech stuff, you know, you post lookouts. And that's all, you know, documented in the report. And the slightly higher-tech stuff is to have good, in inverted commas, medical support that works out when you should give the drugs to limit the time when you're going to be detectable. and to say, okay, so we inject the compound now, and that means that as long as you don't get tested the next 24 hours, you'll be okay, or the next 12 hours. So it's a combination of high tech and low tech. And at the time when Lance and other people, it wasn't just Lance Armstrong who was implicated, but other teams as well.
Yes.
At the time, the out of competition testing, I would say, was not aggressive enough. So teams didn't have to say exactly where they were at any time. And if they did, they had an excuse, they could escape. So it's not just testing in the tour, it's also out of competition testing that was lacking or not as efficient as it could have been, and that's partly changed.
But are you saying that as much as this report focuses on Lance Armstrong and his teammates, that the doping is pervasive when it comes to professional cycling?
Well, I mean, Lance wasn't the first, and U.S. Postal wasn't the first team. So there was a whole history of it, as Joe would, of course, say before then, with a number of teams. Most of the teams were involved with doping. And then the French authorities decided enough was enough when they were just discovering loads of drugs in people's cars, and they got involved. Mm-hmm. And then there was an attempt to clean up. And then looked like what happened is that when Lance Armstrong's team came back on, everyone sort of started doping again, and we had the second wave of doping. So it's it has a long history, and I would say that it's now the cleanest it's been for some time. You can never say a sport is clean, but it has changed the last few years at least.
Well, let me go back to you, Joe Lindsay, and Chris Cooper talks about the sort of low level and high level. This report implicates doctors and people very closely associated with Lance Armstrong and his team. There also was an interesting article in the New York Times about a woman who was basically a masseuse for the team, and she was dropping off things and picking up things and hiding evidence of doping.
Yes, I believe that was referring to Emma O'Reilly, who was
exactly
one of the first people who came out and spoke of what she saw and what she did at the postal team. One of the central figures in the investigation is a guy named Jose Marti, who goes by Pepe. And Pepe is a soigneur, is the name. It's the term is more like assistant, but they also, one of their duties is to give the riders massages. But Pepe was also a fairly accomplished drug courier. He was the primary guy who was responsible for bringing drugs to the riders, for selling drugs to riders. He apparently had a little bit of a side business going, selling drugs to riders on other teams. So these, there were lots of enablers and abettors and co-conspirators, if you will, in this whole thing, going from doctors to team managers, down to, you know, even the basic staff of the teams who helped out with this kind of thing. It was a complex program to run.
Well, let me quote something that Emma O'Reilly said in the New York Times. She says it was prevalent but discreet. The drugs were just part and parcel of things. You didn't analyze it at the time. It was just part of things. And they go on to say she once traveled from France to Spain and picked up illegal pills for Mr. Armstrong, delivered them to him in a McDonald's parking lot outside Nice. Another time she said she took a package of testosterone and got it into the hands of another rider. And I have to go back to you, Joe Lindsay. This sounds like some kind of, you know, illegal drug operation, and I don't mean just performance-enhancing drugs. I mean, it sounds like what you might hear having to do with the mafia.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they were trying to get this stuff to the riders and during races and have it kind of out of plain view. And one of the stories that really comes back to me is a story about one of the team doctors who, when Armstrong was being tested, this goes back to what Dr. Cooper was saying about low-tech methods of getting around things. The doctor, the tester had come to test Armstrong, and so the doctor hopped onto the team bus, grabbed a bag of saline solution, hid it in his coat, and walked right past the tester into Armstrong's hotel room, shut the door, and was basically able to give him an infusion, which altered his blood chemistry enough that they were able to avoid testing positive. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those things that was sort of like hiding in plain sight, right? And this kind of thing happened apparently all the time.
Well, even going back to the report and back to you, Chris Cooper, they talk about a code of silence, the omerta, that people, including some of these doctors and trainers, implicated, but not saying a word.
Yes, and I think we should at this point. Praise those who still try to stand up against the omerta, and who were basically kicked off the tour. Some of the cyclists and some of the people you mentioned previously who came out and tried to say what was going on. So, but within the professional cyclist, if you broke the omerta, you were ostracised. I mean, there's issues of you know, certain teams just stopping another team having any chance of winning because one of their lead people had broken the code of silence. So it was a fairly systematic and pretty much tour wide that you didn't talk about this stuff.
And picking up on some of the things that you have written, Chris Cooper, and we're talking about blood transfusions, is there a concise way on the radio that you can talk about how these performance-enhancing drugs work? And in the end, do they actually work? Do they increase performance?
Yes, I can do it fairly straightforwardly, I hope. Armstrong took a number of things, and he took cortisol, and he took, or alleged to have taken cortisol, testosterone. But the core thing that helps people in the Tour de France is blood doping. It's a way of increasing the number of red blood cells. If you have more red blood cells, you can carry more oxygen around the body, because it's your red blood cells are what carries the oxygen around the body. It's a protein called hemoglobin. The red protein gives blood its red colour that carries the oxygen around the body. So if you lose a lot of blood, you have a blood transfusion to bring yourself back to normal delivery of oxygen. Mm-hmm. It turns out that if you take your normal amount of blood and give yourself extra blood, then you have a super amount of oxygen. And when you're doing long-distance races, like long-distance running, like the Tour de France, the more oxygen you've got, the better you could perform. So it's fairly straightforward, fairly well understood. The trick then is, how do you manage to get those extra red blood cells without triggering the doping test?
Yeah, did you want to add something to that, Joe Lindsay?
As Dr. Cooper mentions, you wanted to increase the level of red blood cells. And so there were a number of different ways to do that and get around the tests. You could use blood transfusions. You could use EPO. We heard rumors in the early 2000s of riders using synthetic blood substitutes of a couple of different varieties. Thankfully, it doesn't seem like that ever took off. But what happened was that oxygen vector doping, as we called it, was so effective that it basically forced a scenario where if you wanted to be competitive, you had to use it, even if you didn't want to.
And the idea that you would get that much of an extra boost, this is obviously, and I'm thinking of the Tour, you know, highly competitive, very challenging course. And are you saying, Joe Lindsay, we're almost up in a break here, that in order to compete, you have to dope?
Yeah, basically, if you wanted to do well at a major stage race like the Tour de France, you basically had to resort to this kind of thing. The Tour, the margins of victory are very small, and I think it's a little bit distorted in the final overall, but what would happen is that most of the advantages are forged on these, you know, these spots, these single climbs that would finish a stage of the race and that kind of thing, and that's where these gains would be made, and if you could not stay with the leaders at that point, you would have to drop back, and that's where you would see these kind of separations open up. And blood doping meant the difference between being able to sustain that pace and not.
And that's Joe Lindsay, who joined us along with Chris Cooper. We are talking about professional cycling, Lance Armstrong, and allegations of doping. He was stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles yesterday. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. As part of a citywide celebration of Frank Furness on the anniversary of his death, PAFA is exhibiting architectural drawings of the Furness-designed historic landmark building. On view through December 30th, these rare drawings document the evolution of this historical building. More information online at pafa.org or by phone at 215-972-7600.
Thank you for making our recent fall membership campaign a success. This is Jeff Bundy, Director of Member Relations at WHYY. Today, you likely tuned to WHYY to help you distill the points you need to know after last night's presidential debate. WHYY provides context and analysis with your best interests in mind, and today's post-debate coverage is a prime example of what your membership supports. If you didn't have the chance to become a member during our campaign, I hope you'll do so now at whyy.org. And thank you.
Medford Lees, a not-for-profit community serving those ages 55-plus and guided by Quaker principles, supports WHYY. This fall, there's an opportunity to explore, learn, and discover with Medford Lees as they launch their new Pathways series. Pathways features public programming on topics covering art, politics, music, history, horticulture, and more. Full details about Medford Lees public events, educational programming, and its campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, are online at medfordlees.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the case against Lance Armstrong. He was stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles yesterday after being accused by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency of running a massive doping ring. We're talking about how he was able to elude authorities for many years, which he clearly was able to do, and what it says about professional cycling. We're talking with Joe Lindsay, contributing writer for Bicycling Magazine, Chris Cooper, director of the Center for Sports and Exercise Science at the University of Essex. And we're taking calls. Any questions or comments that you might have, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Chris Cooper, let me go back to you. What are the risks associated with performance-enhancing drugs?
Well, I think it depends on the drug you're taking. With the sort of blood doping, the concern has always been that you might make your blood a bit too thick and they wouldn't flow so well if you got it wrong, and therefore you might end up having possibility of a stroke or a cardiac event. I think the sort of rather sad thing is that the better you are at the doping, probably the less likely you are to have the side effects because you do it very carefully. Mm. The big concern with blood transfusions is infection as well. So you're taking the blood out, hoping to store the blood, put it back in. And again, what's going to happen now, I think, is that this won't be done professionally in inverted commas. It'll be done by the odd cyclist. Then there'll be a real risk of that blood being in someone's fridge, not being looked after properly, and then getting an infection. There certainly have been instances of that in the past. So as it goes even more underground, less well controlled, it becomes much more dangerous. But we don't want to have, if you have the rules, people shouldn't break the rules, and that's the issue.
Let me go back to you, Joe Lindsay, and help us understand, because in one sense there's some friction between the International Cycling Union and the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. What is their relationship, if they have one, and how do they feel about each other?
Well, the UCI, the governing body for the sport of cycling, has had a traditionally contentious relationship with both the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency and its sort of parent organization, the World Anti-Doping Agency. A lot of that is kind of the standard bureaucratic struggle for control and turf, because the UCI runs its own anti-doping operations, and WADA is kind of responsible as the world overseer of those. So there's that kind of clash, but outside of that, there's been this thread that the UCI has pushed back on USADA from a standpoint of jurisdiction. Whose right is it to investigate these charges? And the thought is that the UCI is essentially trying to cover for itself because they were either complicit or at the very least incompetent at the time that these things were going on. You had incidents like Armstrong offering two donations totaling $125,000 to the UCI just after he had turned up a suspicious test at a race in Switzerland and had met with the laboratory director to sort of offer an explanation. And this sort of thing is extraordinary. I mean, it simply would not happen today, but in 2001 it was the kind of thing that happened. And that has led to allegations that the UCI was not only incompetent and simply unable or unacknowledging of the problem, but was actually complicit in trying to cover it up and protect star riders like Armstrong from repercussions.
And the UCI had tested him multiple times, yes, Joe?
Yeah, the UCI says that they claim that they have tested Armstrong 215 times over his career. Now, most of those are going to be in-competition tests because the UCI's own numbers show that even as late as 2006, their out-of-competition testing program totaled about 156 tests for all, say, 1,000 cyclists who are in the testing program. So that's an infinitesimally small number. So most of the tests that they put Armstrong through were in-competition testing, and the tests themselves are somewhat fallible. They always have been, and they continue to be.
You agree with that, Chris Cooper?
Not entirely. I think the one-off tests are can be beaten, but I think if you have an effective program in place where you can really go where someone is and know where they are at any time, do the test, you have more chance of getting them. And also, they've introduced this new idea of the athlete biological passport, the blood passport, where they take blood and track it through time and see if there's indirect evidence of blood doping. And that's, if you look at the report, they're doing a very small amount about actual doping tests that are might implicate Armstrong in the report. But what part of that is the fact that when you look at his blood levels, his red blood cell levels, they're highly suspicious in his comeback in the tour. So I think I'm not quite as negative as Joe about this, but it's an ongoing battle. And clearly you introduce a new test, so this blood passport they've introduced, where they track an athlete with time with blood tests, and then the athletes dope differently in order to try and pass the test. So I think it's an ongoing battle. I think it had a bad time when it really was very ineffective. I think it's arguably a bit better now. And I think part of the reason for the tour being a little bit cleaner now and times going down a bit is that some of the cyclists got a bit scared. I mean, you know, when a new test came in, like they got scared when the EPO test came in, they switched to blood boosting and blood doping, and they're not completely sure exactly what to switch to now. So there's a sort of a moment where the dopers have got a slight problem compared to where they were. It might change.
Well, going back to you, Joe Lindsay, and Lance Armstrong has basically denies the allegations in this report, says that from his perspective, he won 7 Tour de France cycling races. Does he have any credibility on this issue?
I don't believe so, no. I think, you know, if Lance is saying that, then he is essentially lying to himself as well as everybody else. He may feel that, you know, what he's saying is essentially yes, you know, even if he's tacitly admitting, yes, I was doping. But everybody else was doing it too, so I still won on a level playing field. And that is one of those myths that I think just simply need to go away, because on 2 counts for Armstrong, one of which was the simple scale of what he was involved in was far past what almost anybody else was involved in. You know, payments totaling $1 million to this coach slash doctor who was responsible for kind of laying out his training and doping program. You know, this was an era where a rider like Dave Zabriskie, who testified, you know, was earning $40,000 to $50,000 a year, and Armstrong was paying, you know, several times that amount per year in money to one coach to help him dope. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is simply that, especially with respect to oxygen vector doping, that not all athletes respond identically. If you take an athlete who has a lower amount of hemoglobin in his blood naturally and is still a good cyclist, compared to a cyclist who has a higher level of hemoglobin, let's say those two are, you know, functionally similar cyclists from a standpoint of ability and talent. If you blood dope both of those riders, then the rider who starts out at a lower level of hemoglobin has much more room to improve. So basically, you've created a situation where the rider who wins is the one whose physiology is most amenable to doping.
What do you think about that, Chris Cooper?
There's two ways of viewing that. One is to say at least you level the playing field by saying, okay, you all at least have the same number of red blood cells. I'm not sure I agree with that, because that is sort of doper's charter. So that is part of the argument that people who dope say, is that, you know, and certainly some of the philosophers say, well, let's try and level the playing field with everyone doping. I think that's a problem, because someone will always do a bit more and do something more dangerous if you try that. But yeah, it's clearly true that people respond differently to doping as they respond differently to training. And I think what Joe says there is completely right.
And looking ahead, and I don't know if it's possible even to do this, Chris Cooper, but looking ahead, and if this is a game of cat and mouse between the cyclists and the organizations who oversee cycling, you know, what's going to be the next test, and then what's going to be the next thing that a rider is going to do to elude that test?
Well, if I knew that, I would.
I realise I'm sort of asking you.
I can
suspect
it. Well, there are lots of compounds. So EPO is this compound that increases your number of red blood cells, and that's what one of the main compounds Lance Armstrong was accused of taking. There are new drugs coming on the market that will do the same. So they're in clinical trials. It's quite possible athletes are trying to get hold of them. It's also, I know for sure, that anti-doping agents are trying to develop tests for them. And I think certainly in terms of the Olympics, where you keep the samples for 8 years, they try and measure everything, and then in the 8 years they go away and try and find the things people might have been doping with. So there are new compounds out there, and I think athletes will try those compounds, but they have a risk, because a compound can always be its principle detected unless it's got a very short half-time in the blood. So I think there are new stuff potentially out there, that will be tried, no doubt. It's the institution you need to sort of break up. If you want to try and remove doping as much as possible, you don't want all the money that the Postal and Armstrong's team were putting into doping. That makes them, it's problematic. You don't want East Germany. We haven't mentioned East Germany, but
yeah, go ahead.
You know, we could say that, you know, this was the most sophisticated system, but there was a whole state controlling doping for a while, you know, and winning loads of gold medals, massively outperforming, and they were doing it very scientifically. All the resources, in fact, bigger resources than were going in from the Armstrong team. So this happens, and when you need to break up those sort of institutional and state doping, at least it gives you a chance then to make the doping more accessible and reduce the level.
And that's Chris Cooper. He's a professor of biochemistry, also director of the Center for Sports and Exercise Science at the University of Essex, author of a book called Run, Swim, Throw, Cheat, The Science Behind Drugs in Sport. And also with us, Joe Lindsay. He's a contributing writer for Bicycling Magazine and has closely followed Lance Armstrong's career, written on pro cycling and cycling's doping problem for over a decade now. He's also an amateur bike racer. And we are talking about Lance Armstrong and doping, the Tour de France. Lance Armstrong stripped of his medals, his titles yesterday, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Chris from Princeton to join our conversation. And Chris, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi. I just had a comment. You know, like, people are always going to take measures to get an advantage, and obviously at some point it crosses the line. But when you talk about doping, for some reason, when we're talking about EPO, it does not rise to the same amount of emotion in me and the same amount of cheating as anabolic steroids would. I mean, people have trained at altitude for a long time to gain an erythrocyte count advantage. So, I mean, so it's just basically a comment. I just kind of wonder how other people look at that.
Okay.
Because I know personally, I don't get as offended when I do when I hear about the institutionalization of the cheating and everything that they went through. Just what they're doing to
Yeah, we hear you, Chris, and your phone is going in and out. And Chris,
can I answer that with an analogy?
Yes, you can,
to steroids.
Chris Cooper, go ahead.
So the point of taking anabolic steroids is to increase your muscle mass. So you can do that by training in the gym or by taking anabolic steroids. If I took anabolic steroids and didn't train in the gym, I'd increase my muscle mass. You do the two together, you get even bigger advantage. Exactly the same with EPO. You train your cycling, you improve how well you deliver oxygen, you add EPO, you do it further. So I think the analogy isn't correct. I think EPO, you can get higher. You get to levels you can't possibly reach with altitude training or with sleeping in low oxygen tents, which is what the alternative people use. So I think it's the fact you can get beyond where you can otherwise get to that is the concern of people. And I think the argument is that's the same thing of anabolic steroids. So I think they're similar in that sense. I don't get the fact that they're different. But people have different views about different drugs. Anabolic steroids are a sex hormone, and certainly people have views about women athletes taking male sex hormones and how the side effects are. So there are different issues there.
How do you see it, Joe Lindsay?
I can see that in certain sports, steroids would be, you know, kind of more objectionable than for cycling. You know, if you're talking about football, for instance, steroid abuse would probably be more important and maybe have more of an effect than oxygen vector doping, simply to, you know, increase the muscle mass and the size of the athlete, the lean muscle mass in particular. For cycling, because it's an endurance sport, oxygen vector doping is the be-all, end-all. And I also want to go back to something that Dr. Cooper said as well, where, yes, you can go to altitude and you can increase your red blood cells, although they will not increase as much as they would doing something like EPO. But one of the things that we find also with training at altitude is that there's a sort of wearing down effect where you know, the body's not recovering as well, and which means that you can't sustain the kind of training loads that you need. And one of the things that comes up with EPO or oxygen vector doping is that it was partly for use in competition to let you ride faster, but a lot of the times that these guys would go to these training camps, you know, in these remote mountains,
the whole idea was to go there to do drugs and so that they could sustain the kind of massive training loads that they needed to get to a point where they could, you know, where they could win the Tour de France. So EPO was essentially, in this way, was also a recovery drug, which is something that steroids are as well, but for cycling in particular, the way that EPO acts on the blood was just far more effective. So for me, the EPO use was actually far, and blood doping was far more objectionable than the steroids.
And Joe, I think we touched on this earlier, but even looking at professional cycling, are there people now competing who are not using these performance-enhancing drugs?
Yes, there always have been clean cyclists. There always have been people who decided that they didn't want to do this. And sometimes that meant that they had to walk away from the sport, like Scott Mercier and Darren Baker, who left the postal team rather than use drugs. Sometimes that meant they were forced out of the sport, like a guy like Christophe Bassons, who was the only member of the Festina team in 1998 who was not using performance-enhancing drugs. He was forced out of the Tour de France the next year, partly by Armstrong, and left the sport entirely not long after that. And then there were riders who continued to ride clean and sort of kept their head down, didn't say anything about it, but they never really enjoyed the kind of career that they would have had if everybody had been clean.
And how did Armstrong force that rider out?
In 1999, this is one incident. There was another in 2004 with a different rider named Filippo Simeoni that I think we should raise as well. In 1999, with Basson, Basson was writing a column, a daily column for a publication called Le Parisien, and he simply talked about the fact that he did not think that after the Festina scandal in 1998 that things had changed. The speeds were fast. He felt like guys were still doping, and Armstrong came up to him at one point and said things like, well, if that's the way you feel, then you should get out of the sport. And other riders would jeer him. It was kind of a pack mentality of the kind where, you know, Basson basically became a black sheep in his own sport for standing up and saying the right thing. In 2004, there was a rider named Filippo Simeoni who had testified against Michele Ferrari, who was Armstrong's coach, who, you know, Armstrong paid this, you know, $1 million to over 6 years. And Simeoni had testified against Ferrari, but had never said a word about Armstrong. And Armstrong came out and called Simeoni a liar, and said he was out to destroy cycling. And then one day, late in the 2004 Tour de France, Simeoni joined a breakaway up the road from the main pack, hoping for a stage win. Armstrong, who was then in the race lead, jumped out of the pack, rode up to the breakaway, got Simeoni, and said, "We don't want you here." And basically said, as long as I, you know, the dynamic was, as long as the yellow jersey was in front, then everybody behind was going to chase, and there was no way that the breakaway could survive and hope for a stage win. So Simeoni gave up his chance and drifted back to the pack with Armstrong, and then as they came back to the pack, Armstrong was seen laughing and made a zip the lips gesture, which this was the kind of, you know, retribution and bullying that would force guys who were clean to sort of, if they were clean, they certainly weren't going to talk about it.
And Chris Cooper, about 30 seconds before our break here, but this is obviously high-level competition. Does that surprise you, shock you, this kind of behavior?
I think that was quite shocking, actually, especially because it was noted on the videos, and it should have perhaps been more taken at the time. Can I just make a quick point about the point you're making, that you seem to imply that because everyone's doping at the moment still, and I think we must be very, very careful not to say about historical events that are well documented. We have the USADA report, therefore means that cycling currently everyone's doping. How can you win being clean? I think that's a very dangerous attitude to take, and there are people clean who are still potentially winning now, so we shouldn't take that attitude and tarnish current people from what did occur a reasonable time ago. So it's very important to be innocent until proven, and always with doping you have to take that view in my mind.
No,
so it's important.
And I appreciate that. Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY and celebrates the new partnership of Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra. Yannick conducts Brahms' Fourth Symphony, and violin virtuoso Joshua Bell plays Leonard Bernstein's Eloquent Serenade. Tickets at philorc.org and 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Brahms and Joshua Bell, with Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra. In the early days of the Iraq War, Marines fired on a family in three cars that didn't heed their warning to stop or turn around. Three members of the family were killed.
On the next Fresh Air, one of the Marines, Lou Lobello, tells us how he was haunted by the experience and recently managed to locate and meet two survivors with the help of reporter Dexter Filkins, who will also join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Gratz College supports WHYY. On November 4th, Gratz College presents the Esther Tuzman Memorial Holocaust Teach-In. Robert J. Lifton, psychiatrist and Holocaust scholar, will discuss the genocidal mind, followed by breakout seminars and survivor testimonies. CLE for attorneys and Act 48 for teachers available. For information on the Holocaust Teach-In and Gratz College graduate programs in Holocaust and Genocide Studies, gratz.edu. gratz.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about professional cycling, the problem of doping, and Lance Armstrong. Chris Cooper is a professor of biochemistry, director of the Center for Sports and Exercise Science at the University of Essex, author of Run, Swim, Throw, Cheat, The Science Behind Drugs in Sport. Joe Lindsay, a contributing writer for Bicycling Magazine, has been writing about Armstrong's career and the problem of doping when it comes to professional cycling. He's also an amateur bike racer, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments, do give us a call. Let's see what Charlie from Westchester has to say. And Charlie, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Your guests have been dancing around it pretty much the whole show. I'd like to know if either one of them could tell us definitively, has Lance Armstrong failed a doping test? Has Lance Armstrong failed a drug test? You were just talking about the pack mentality. Is the pack mentality now forcing Armstrong out? I mean, I'd accept this much more easily if he'd actually failed a test. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks a lot.
Charlie, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Chris Cooper, go ahead, and then Joe Lindsay, go ahead.
So I'll give the USADA comment, first of all, which is that you don't have to fail a doping test to be convicted of doping. Marion Jones passed all her tests and was convicted of doping from the evidence, actually she of herself, really. So I think that's the first point, is that that's not the evidence that's required. Having said that, within the USADA documentation, there are this pretty strong scientific evidence that some of the samples that Lance Armstrong had were contained, you know, with evidence of what oxygen vector doping, as Joe says. It's the Chris Gore is one of the experts in blood doping and anti-doping from Australia, said a 1 in a million chance that these samples were not due to doping. And it doesn't mean that there has to be correct procedures in order to convict somebody on a test, but there are a range of tests now that would or samples when reanalyzed, and UCI have not released all the samples, that would suggest it's pretty clear with all the other evidence that the idea that he's never failed a test, yes, while he hasn't been convicted because of a test, the scientific evidence is pretty damning as well, even if not enough to convict him in its own right.
And Joe Lindsay, going back to you, looking at this USADA investigation, there were dozens of witnesses. They looked at bank records, email communications, and then they did look at some tests as well.
Yes, they did. I'll start kind of chronologically. In 1999, Armstrong did actually test positive for cortisone during the Tour de France. He produced what's called a therapeutic use exemption, which is sort of a doctor's note that allows him to use the substance in question. But it's later come out through some of this testimony that TUE was very likely forged. So there is one positive test. In 2001 and 2002, at two different races in Switzerland and France, Armstrong produced samples that were, at the very least, were borderline suspicious suspect for EPO. And then in 2005, L'Equipe, the French sports daily, did a fantastic, just fascinating investigation of a bunch of retests of samples from the 1999 tour that showed that Armstrong turned up EPO in at least four samples. One of those tests basically show that the EPO test works as kind of a threshold test. You know, naturally occurring EPO and synthetic EPO have slightly different chemical signatures. And in order to have a positive test at that time, you had to have, or in 2005, you had to have about 80% of the EPO in the body had to look like it came from synthetic sources, had to be in the synthetic part of the band. One of the tests that Armstrong returned showed 100% of the EPO in that synthetic kind of area. And I'm simplifying this a little bit, but that was the kind of the basic gist. So yes, there were positive tests. One other thing I would add is that when you're dealing with scientific tests for doping, the penalty is very severe. It's 2 years ban. It's loss of reputation, loss of the ability to compete, loss of basically the ability to make money as a professional athlete. So this is a very high threshold, and to scientists take this kind of thing very seriously. They don't want to have false positives. So what you end up with is a test where oftentimes the threshold for a positive test for a substance like EPO, which can be naturally or artificially occurring, ends up being very high. So when you get to a point where, you know, you have 80% of the EPO in the body comes from synthetic, that's basically a level that's simply high enough to be beyond a reasonable doubt.
But Joe, if he tested positively over that period of time, why did it take 2012 and the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency to release this investigation?
Well, some of that goes back to the UCI's possible role after 2001, when Armstrong made his $125,000 donation and had a meeting with the lab director over the positive test, which, you know, as I mentioned earlier, is just an incredible breach of protocol. These kinds of things wouldn't happen today. That would probably be reported as a positive test today. You know, as Dr. Cooper said, the tests have gotten better, and, you know, today certainly clean cyclists can and do win often. But at that time, this was the way things were. So things got sort of shoved underneath the rug, as it were.
Chris Cooper, what about things like caffeine? I mean, the legal and everyday substances, does that have a performance-enhancing ability?
Yeah, I mean, caffeine is probably as good as any of the other stimulants that are on the banned list. So caffeine is great. And in fact, many of the track cyclists really sort of fetishize caffeine because it's a legal drug.
Right.
They use it a lot, and it's very important. So and the new thing is beetroot juice, which is this wonderful thing, which basically it's nitrate, but in cyclists and other sports, they take it as beetroot juice. And that is amazing in terms of improving your efficiency of using your oxygen. It's a very surprising result finding, but for many athletes, that's quite a big enhancement, and that's completely legal. I mean, you can get the same thing by eating huge numbers of vegetables. So there are lots of things that improve performance, and you know, the best teams work on all those things carefully, what works for the individual cyclist. So part of why Lance Armstrong won was that he had lots of good support for the normal things that cyclists need to be better. I mean, you know, not just all the training programs, that takes money as well. But he had the added, you know, boost of using the performance enhancing things that were cheating. I mean, that's basically what it is. It's, you know, we can get hung up at it being drugs, but it's just against the rules. So, you know, that's an issue. So lots of things are available to improve performance. Some of them happen to be banned.
And that's Chris Cooper joining us along with Joe Lindsay talking about Lance Armstrong and professional cycling and the use of doping or misuse of performance-enhancing drugs and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Joe, going back to you, those riders who came forth and talked about the fact that they were using these performance-enhancing drugs and essentially came clean, how should they be dealt with, you think?
I think, honestly, they have to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis because the timing of them coming clean, the level of information that they gave, and the reasons that they came clean all differ. If you look at somebody like Frankie Andreu, for instance, he confessed his own doping back in 2006 when there was very little to be gained from this and when he basically was subject to just simply a lot of criticism for what he'd said. Contrast that with a rider like George Hincapie or Levi Leipheimer, who came forward only when they were contacted in the course of a criminal investigation and basically were delivered a subpoena. You must come and testify. In at least Leipheimer's case, came and testified and pleaded the fifth against self-incrimination and only really testified after being told that he would be granted limited immunity from prosecution. So there's a scale of all of these kinds of things. And then you take somebody like David Zabriskie, for instance, as soon as Floyd Landis allegations became known and there was a federal criminal investigation started, Zabriskie was on the doorstep of the Los Angeles District Attorney's office 2 days later to give a statement. Didn't ask for immunity, didn't ask for any kind of reduced sporting bat, anything like that. He wanted to tell a story. So I think you have to look at all of these guys individually and say, you know, what was your reason for coming forward? What did you say? And really, also, most importantly for those guys who are active now, still as cyclists, what are you doing now? What has your life been like since you left this Postal Service or the Discovery Channel team?
Let me get Jack from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us. And Jack, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good morning.
I had a quick question. Can you talk a little bit about the negative effects of EPO on cyclists? Because I know the big hubbub about anabolic steroids within the baseball community was the effects that it would have on young players taking it in high school, taking anabolic steroids and doing damage to their bodies. And we didn't want that emulation amongst our young athletes. It seems like there's a fine line between performance-enhancing drugs and just advances in modern technology. Does EPO share the same health risks as, say, something like anabolic steroids?
Jack, let me toss that to Chris Cooper. Thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Yeah, well, with a lot of these drugs, it's difficult to know the long-term health risks because you can't do a proper study. So as a scientist, it's unclear. The concern with, as I said before, I think with things like EPO, is if you get your blood too thick, that's really a potential problem. If you get it wrong, if you like, if you dope badly. But what low-level doping with EPO means long-term is not completely clear. I mean, some people have EPO as therapy. So people with kidney disease and kidney damage have lifelong EPO, and you know, but they have a disease that needs to be cured. What the situation would be with people who just took EPO 10 years down the line, I think we don't have enough evidence to say whether that's, you know, what the effects would be. But if you make your blood way too thick, you've got a problem.
Joe Lindsay, going back to you and going back to the Tour de France, since Lance Armstrong has been stripped of his wins there, should, and it looks like perhaps they're going to just have a kind of a hole where his name was, should the Tour sort of rethink who came in first and who came in second and who came in third?
At this point, the Tour de France has said that they would prefer not to see the titles re-awarded, simply because as you go back through the placings in the top 10, it's very difficult to find a rider who we absolutely know was clean. If you look at the 1999 Tour de France, the second place rider was Alex Zula, who the year before had been involved with the Festina scandal. 2001, 2000, 2003 was Jan Ulrich, who has come forward and admitted to making, you know, mistakes as a rider, has basically admitted doping. As you go down the classification, it's very difficult to find a rider who you can say, yes, this person was clean. So Christian Prudhomme, the director of the Tour de France, has said that he would prefer those titles simply to remain blank as a sort of reminder of what an awful time it was for the sport, and hopefully to move forward and to remember that as a reason to not get back there.
And Chris Cooper, you mentioned, and I appreciate you saying, you know, it's important not to paint too broad a brush and to implicate riders today, but if there is a zero tolerance policy and more transparency and perhaps even more surprise testing, would that give people confidence in the Tour de France?
Well, yes. I mean, I think and those things sort of are in place really at the moment. So this is all referring to events occurring at least 4 or 5 years ago by and large, and in the sort of the institutional way it's been described. So it's not so institutional that the team, there are cleaner teams out there. So it's a shame that the argument, this would be nice for cycling, I'm not a cycling journalist, if this had been decided and cleared up 5 years ago.
Right.
Because coming at a time when cycling has made some effort, so I think that's a potential setback. But you know, I think it has to carry on and carry on with the path it's taking, and that relates to the politics of UCI and USADA, which Joe has referred to, and I think that still needs resolving where the blame lies with what has happened in the past.
In fact, let me get Dan from New Egypt, New Jersey, to speak to that point. And Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
It seems to me that the UCI was complicit in all of this. I mean, it seems like it was a rampant problem. Are there any penalties against any of the executives at UCI coming forward? Anybody looking into that?
Let me toss that first to you, Joe Lindsay.
Yesterday, in their announcement that they were going to strip Armstrong of his titles, UCI President Pat McQuaid again basically refused to take any responsibility for the UCI's own actions during that time. you know, he mentioned that he himself has only been president since 2005, even though before that he was the president of the Professional Road Commission and is the sort of hand-picked successor of the previous president, Hein Verbruggen. So that there's been very little effort right now on their behalf to take responsibility, and I think that that kind of leadership vacuum presents a problem for the sport, because the people who are in positions of authority right now don't aren't granted a lot of credibility or trust by people in the sport, whether they be riders or race directors or team managers or fans, that they really have the best interest at heart and are the people who can really continue this this process of cleaning up the sport. And I say continue because yes, they have started it, but there are more things to do for sure.
He's still suing a journalist at the moment, Paul Kibbage, one of the few journalists who from the very beginning has been or recently has been coming out against what was happening with Lance Armstrong from an early time. And the UCI are still suing Paul Kimmage for defamation. So I think that case might resolve some of these issues. So I think the UCI, mm-hmm. I mean, what USADA said pretty much some of the bad things that other people have said who've got sued. So I can't see this being sitting here in a neutral way. But either UCI were doing what USADA said, or they weren't. Right. So something needs to be resolved, it seems to me. But I'm a biochemist. I'm not a I'm not a cycling expert.
Fair enough, Joe Lindsay. We're almost out of time here, but looking ahead, is Lance Armstrong going to face criminal charges?
That is yet to be determined. I contacted the district attorney's office in Central California and asked them if, in light of the information that was released in the USADA report, if they were considering reopening the investigation, and they said that they would decline to respond to that. So mm-hmm. there is a possibility that that would come up. I think more likely what you'll see are civil lawsuits against him in the form of perjury charges and in the form of some lawsuits to regain money that was paid to him. An insurance company called SCA Promotions insured the value of Armstrong's tour wins, bonuses for those. They would like their money back. That's sort of every possibility that the federal government will actually want its money back for sponsoring the team through the United States Postal Service. So this certainly isn't over for Armstrong.
Indeed. Well, my thanks to you, Joe Lindsay, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Chris Cooper, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Jared Brausch helping us out today. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. And you can check us out online. Go to our new improved WHYY.org/Radio Times.